The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm your host today, Amy Newell-Tyreen, editor at ExchangeWire. This is actually my first episode, which isn't a special, so that's quite exciting. And I'm pleased to be here with Lindsay Rowntree, COO at ExchangeWire. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hi, Amy. I am delighted to have you be on your debut MadTech podcast. Very exciting.
Yeah, me too. And John Still, our head of content. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I'm thrilled to have passed over the hosting seat to you for today. Nice to be on the other side of the microphone. So yeah, looking forward to a chat.
Yeah. So today's episode will be covering PayPal's plans to start its own ad network, the latest news surrounding OpenAI, and also the latest on TikTok's legal position in the US. So on to our first story. The Wall Street Journal reports PayPal has plans to boost its growth by starting an ad network. The ad business will be built around the data it generates by tracking users' purchases, as well as broader spending behaviors of those who use its services. So I'll go to you, Lindsay, first. With this move, how could PayPal's future look?
I think it's a really interesting move for PayPal. Obviously, another big brand marketer going down the kind of the becoming a publisher, selling its data route. I think it's really interesting. It's another walled garden, I think, is the big point to make here. You know, it's another, you know, Uber have done it, Walmart have done it, kind of in slightly different contexts. But PayPal have some incredibly rich data. They are inserted in many different people's lives. It would be interesting for marketers looking for that kind of data. And the article sort of said they're looking not just for endemic brands that are, you know, similar, that are buying across PayPal's, using PayPal's buying engine and buying across PayPal's platforms, but also non-endemic brands that aren't related, that actually could find that data really, really useful and interesting for them to be able to make purchases or get research from customers over. So I think it's going to be, it's a big move. It makes a lot of sense. They could end up just finding out that their ads business is bigger than the rest of their business. They've got fingers in many, many pies. And I think that they will do incredibly well out of it. It's just interesting to see what the structure will look like how advertisers can buy from the platform, how they can access the data, etc., etc. It's not just obviously buying on ads on kind of PayPal owned sites, they're being able to buy on in other properties too. So again, you know, a bit like the other brands I mentioned that have done something similar. But yeah, from my perspective, I think PayPal doing this makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned, like, it's likely this could kind of become the biggest part of what they do, which is, yeah, it's interesting to see how that turns out. Because, yeah, they have, like you said, really, you know, a huge amount of data. They've got a lot of rich data there. So, yeah. And so, John, just going into a bit deeper on the advertising side of things, what exactly does this mean for advertisers?
I think it's, like, super attractive for advertisers to want to get involved in. Like Lindsay mentioned about, you know, Uber have done a similar thing, and they've got Mark Grether coming over from Uber Advertising to take charge of this and to make the business out of it. But they know where you spend your money, which is a really, really rich data for advertisers. They know where people are sending their cash, and they, you know, the data points they have as a financial service provider are unmatched. It's really interesting that they're making this move. Again, it's kind of, you know, the phrase that our dear Kieran O'Kane hates, everything is an ad network, sprang to mind as soon as I saw this. You know, eventually people are turning to advertising and using the data that they've collected to make money from it. But yeah, I think in terms of people getting involved, it'd be really interesting to see what they come up with in terms of formats, what the ad offering is. But yeah, for the data they can offer at kind of point of sale almost, it's a fantastic, very interesting move.
Yeah, it makes me wonder who's next, because if you start getting the kind of, you know, PayPal is, for all the purposes, a financial institution, you start getting them involved, as you said, John, like really, really rich data, they know where everyone spends their money. Like that is gold dust for a lot of people to be able to understand kind of what people's purchasing habits are, not browsing habits, which is what a lot of people have access to already, but actual purchasing habits across every single different type of business, because PayPal is inserted and endemic in so many different types of businesses in terms of what you can purchase through. That's going to be really interesting. And you wonder how that will encourage other financial institutions to want to use their data. And it makes you think as well about the privacy side of things and the data restriction side of things, like how far can or will they go, and when will regulators want to make sure that everything is being done above board and data isn't being shared nefariously. It's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah. I mean, they've mentioned in the release that your data will naturally be part of the ad servicing, but there is going to be an opt-out for you if you don't wish it to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of, yeah, it's the same as any opt-out.
That's it. You know, how often do we talk about this? Okay, right. So I, the average person on the street, have just found out that PayPal are going to become an ad network. Brilliant. Okay. What the F is an ad network? What does that mean? And how do I opt out of this thing that I've got no idea what it means? And will they send me detailed information about how to do that and explain what it means to my data? Or will it just be like, oh, if I'm in the know and I know where to go on PayPal, there's a spider on my laptop. That's not nice. Oh, I don't like spiders, for anyone who cares. Anyway, that's fine. I'll just ignore it. Carry on. What was I saying? Yeah, but as the average person on the street that doesn't like spiders, how will I know how to opt out of this? And what that actually means, and how will PayPal communicate that? And, you know, as with everything, it's the usual, like, okay, we're talking about this. Will the average consumer that uses PayPal regularly get what the hell's going on? No.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think people generally will be quite worried about what this means for them and for their personal data, definitely. Because it's, yeah, financial data is obviously probably the data people are most worried about, you know, scams and all this kind of thing. People probably think of that first. So, yeah, that's definitely an important point to make.
Definitely. I mean, it's up there with health data in terms of how sensitive people are about their financial information. So where you spend your money is, you know, it's private, essentially. But it's, you know, that's what we've handed over in terms of companies like PayPal and their growth. And we will, yeah, it's having the opt-out there is an essential. But like Lindsay said, whether it's that people are going to go through a circuitous routine to get rid of it or whether it'll just go with the flow, it remains to be seen. But be interesting to see how regulators look at it as well.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot of people are worried about their data, but they still don't actually take any measures to kind of make sure that it's not being collected. So
no, and largely because they have no idea how to.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it pans out.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the next story. So we'll be looking at a couple of different stories now about OpenAI. They've been in the news a lot at the moment. And the first story is about their latest deal. So a deal signed on Wednesday sees PwC becoming OpenAI's largest customer and the first reseller of its flagship product, ChatGPT. And then the second piece of news about OpenAI is that they've just formed a safety and security committee. In their own words, they describe that the committee will be responsible for making recommendations on critical safety and security decisions for all of their projects. But the committee is being led by insiders. So CEO Sam Altman, alongside directors Brett Taylor, Adam D'Angelo, and Nicole Seligman. So first, let's just talk a bit about OpenAI's rapidly increasing success. Lindsay, what do you think? Is there anything that could stop them at this point?
Money, lack thereof. And genuinely, that I think that is the main thing. And we did talk about this on the podcast a few weeks ago. Like it was about monetizing. I think it's about Google monetizing their AI. And we got onto the fact that, you know, that OpenAI, ChatGPT and obviously Bing's Copilot can charge you £20 a month if you're like just a standard individual user to access special features, etc. And I think that money is the thing that is going to be, well, money and regulation, obviously, but money, I think, before regulation, because regulation isn't quite there yet. And I think the money could run out before the regulation steps in to kind of understand exactly what the laws are. Although the EU law on OpenAI, someone was talking about this yesterday, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but apparently it's very good and kind of is very thoughtful in how it approaches what we as users need to understand and kind of what the limitations are and how it could be used for the average person using generative AI tools. So that's interesting, and I should have read that, but I haven't. Barely read this, so you know, I'm at least prepared for the podcast. But anyway, I think the money thing is interesting, and actually having someone like PwC on board that can help bankroll its continued development will be hugely, hugely helpful. And obviously, OpenAI are looking for these large companies like PwC to do just what PwC have done. And I do believe that this news being out there will cause more large corporate Fortune 500 businesses to do the same thing. Although I read on the article, they reckon that 93% of Fortune 500 businesses are already invested in OpenAI and using it kind of as enterprise users, which I thought was interesting. And that equates to about 600,000 people, whereas I think, Amy, you said this is 100,000 people on PwC. So I think that that's going to be a huge boost in revenue for OpenAI, and that will help them with further development, because I think that, you know, it's developing faster than it can be funded at the moment is how I kind of interpret it. So they need more companies like this, and they also I'd like to have access to that as an individual. So they need to have an entry-level individual person. I get the revenue would be the same, but I'd pay a smaller amount a month potentially to get better access, because I use it for everything. So think about me, the average idiot user that has no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, I think the lack of money, yeah, that's obviously a huge point. I mean, AI is so expensive to kind of, to carry out all the processes that need to be done behind how it works. It's so expensive. So that's definitely one of the places where I guess they could find themselves in problems. But it seems like they have so much backing, so they're in a really strong position at the moment. And the more deals they make, the more it makes others want to follow suit, clearly. So
100%.
And then moving on to the committee they've made, John, what do you think about that, with all of the committee's members being like top executives at OpenAI? How effective is this formation?
I don't know. It's a lot of marking. It's a really nice title to put out there, and you know, you've got the word safety in there, so that's going to impress people. But it's a lot of marking their own homework, which isn't going to fly for very long. I don't think I mean, the questions that AI is throwing up around ethics, around, you know, where is it going? Like Lindsay was saying, it's moving so, so fast. And OpenAI are in such a position of strength, like we were saying, regarding their position in the market and stuff. It seems like all they have to do is not fall over their own feet to win, like to come out. You know, Google are, I don't know, it's like the general election campaign. It's like Rishi Sunak's falling over his own feet with a football, Ed Davies falling off a yacht, and all Keir Starmer has to do is not eat a bacon sandwich in a funny way.
just remain normal. The next couple of weeks, all you got to do, remain so normal.
Yeah, casting OpenAI as the challenger to Google's long-standing overlord. It's interesting to see how they can potentially win, but stuff like this doesn't help. And in terms of what is in their way, Sam Altman has had plenty of questions asked around his leadership, in terms of his style, in terms of what went on with his ousting and subsequent rehiring. For the AI safety, it's very important. Ethics are incredibly important to look at. Regulation is incredibly important around AI and its speedy growth. But this does smack a little bit of, trying to mark your own homework.
It's a starting point, but I think, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And the continued problem with generative AI is that it's growing faster than any regulator can keep up with it, which is true of many things. It's not just like this is the first time this has happened. It's just, like, pick a topic, any topic, regulation can't keep up with it normally. But this is ridiculous in terms of how much it's growing and how new features are being added literally kind of every 5 minutes. And the regulators are still trying to deal with features that were added 5 years ago. And I think it's going to be so interesting, and it will require lots of collaboration. And hopefully, you know, when one country or region creates a kind of safety bill, others will look at that and try and replicate it and follow suit, and it will mean that globally we'll have something that's broadly looks similar. But it's really complicated, and I think that them, as you put it, John, marking their own homework doesn't help matters, because it shows there's something to hide, it shows something to obfuscate. That's the message it puts across, and I think that's not helpful in the current scenario where everyone's a little bit trepidatiously scared of what OpenAI can bring to the world.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, definitely. And Sam Altman was under so much scrutiny before, so now the fact that he's leading this does kind of raise questions and maybe raise concerns for some people. So
yeah, I mean, there's a woman on this panel, which is a nice change for OpenAI. That's a lesson learned.
Just the one, yeah?
Just one, yeah.
All right, cool. Okay. Got to start somewhere. Just roll one woman out. That's fine. Our job's done.
Yeah, progress.
But yeah, they'll kind of have to count on the public thinking that they're taking it seriously, because obviously they could quite easily, even if they do, you know, uncover huge safety concerns, they could easily just cover it up. So
yeah,
it's all in their hands and what they choose to show to the public.
Yeah, no, that's it. And that's why this will, you know, something that on the surface should be a forward thinking and a good thing, a safety and security committee will come under intense scrutiny because of those possibilities, because this is people with responsibilities to a board and a bottom line who are being put responsibility with, which are being given responsibility for being honest about what's going on inside that company.
That was a good sentence there. I enjoyed that.
Yep, I've really mangled that one to hell, haven't I? What a day.
Poor Amy, honestly. I have to do what I have to do.
Yeah.
Sorry, Amy.
Yeah, we're on. Amy's doing brilliantly. Yeah, we're on terrible form.
She's the best performer on this podcast by a long way. Congratulations, Amy.
Okay, let's move on to our final story then. So the final story is about TikTok, and they've also been in the news a lot recently. And the latest on their legal position is that the US court will hear challenges to the potential TikTok ban in September. So the Court of Appeals for Washington, D.C. has set a fast-track schedule to consider the legal challenges to the law, which will ban TikTok in the country unless sold by China-based parent company ByteDance. So how could this hearing shape up, John? What do you think?
I don't know if I can see anything other than the ruling being overturned at the moment. I know that's putting a fairly big stake in the ground, but brands want to use it. Creators are up in arms about it because they, you know, they've built small businesses, they've built careers on the back of it. And I just feel like this appeal, there's more to it than it just being kicked out. I think that it will be really interesting to see what arguments come up, but I'm not sure if they can make it stick. And I'm happy in a couple of months to come down the line and say, oh yeah, they did make it stick and it was bought by a huge company in America. But I really think that it could result in the ban being overturned, or at least extended, giving them more time to sell. The terms were quite stringent on how long ByteDance had to actually divest the app. So I could see that not being the case. I can see that can being kicked if they do stick with the ban. But yeah, I think there's such demand for it. They've built like this monolithic thing that sucks up attention, that has youth audiences. And I wonder what the practicalities of the ban will actually be.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the world's biggest platforms at the moment. It'll be interesting to see what happens. It looks like the case could be quite messy, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what will happen. ByteDance have said that they don't want to divest it. So yeah, I think like you said, it's possible that they might give TikTok extra time. They might, you know, give extra time for it to be sold. But yeah, what do you think, Lindsay?
I think that I'm going to be contrary and disagree with John. I don't think it'll be overturned. I think that it depends how big the lobby is against getting it overturned, right? It depends how influential, you know, the companies that are supporting TikTok and want TikTok to continue are going to be in being able to convince the government, to overturn the ban and allow TikTok to remain. Because Amy, as you said, ByteDance do not want to divest it. So that's not an option. The two options that were given were they divest it or they remove it from the country. So if they're not going to divest it, that's the only other option. And I feel like it's gone a long journey to get to this point. And I just feel like no one's going to let it kind of back out now. And from an advertiser perspective, yes, all right, I love TikTok and I've got, I get loads of revenue from TikTok and I'm able to advertise on TikTok, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take TikTok away from me, I'll just go, all right, fine, I'll go somewhere else. Like I'll go back, I'll put more money in Instagram. I'll give Meta more of my money. You know, the other company that is, you know, shouldn't be given any money by advertisers either, but I will just put my money somewhere else. And that's, if something is becomes less favorable. Like, advertisers go where the people are. And if the people are no longer on TikTok because TikTok no longer exists, then advertisers will just find something else. And will they care that much to lobby against it being banned from the country? In terms of the other sticking point, which John, you obviously pointed out, is the business is created for kind of like SMEs and for kind of individuals. And that is the big thing. It's created an industry or industries out of nothing. And those creators, those content creators, are obviously hugely up in arms because it's been, it could take the livelihood away from them. But again, it's not TikTok. It's a difficult one, right? Because it's not TikTok's fault. Like, TikTok was created. Those guys saw an opportunity, and like every wheeler dealer, when that opportunity comes, is taken away from you, you go and find new opportunity. So you kind of have to just roll with the punches and evolve or die, I think, is the ultimate thing here. I think that is, obviously, I'm being extremely harsh, but I'm looking at it from a very pragmatic perspective. Yes, lots of people will lose their businesses from TikTok being banned from the country, but they're going to have to find new ways of working. They're going to have to find new avenues to be able to sell their products. And that's kind of, you know, where it started in the first place. Some of these people have probably been selling the products they're selling on TikTok for years, and then TikTok just helped give them a massive boost. TikTok being going away again will make them have to find another platform to be able to do that. And I think that that's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. And I don't think the federal government will care enough about that to kind of kick the can down the road or overturn it completely. So I feel like it will go ahead just because everyone is so pig-headedly focused on that being the case. I'm intrigued as to if the alternative would be the case. And incidentally, I'm watching a fascinating, well, not fascinating, but it's cool, documentary on Netflix at the moment about the TikTok dancing cult. And that just kind of shows you the power of TikTok in kind of like convincing young people to, I don't know, join a cult and give all their money away to some cult that claims to be the manager of their dance company. Weird. It's good. Watch it. But anyway.
Yeah, I saw that come up, actually.
It is honestly, if you're into kind of weird documentaries about cults, which I am, it's very good and very worthwhile watching. But it reminds you of how dangerous a place TikTok can be, and that kind of stuff being put on Netflix will not help the federal government kind of go, oh, do you know what? TikTok's brilliant. Let's allow ByteDance even more power and let them actually kind of keep running in our country. Ultimately, they want China out. You know, that's ultimately what it boils down to. And if ByteDance won't divest it, and if they don't want to, and they don't want China in the country, what are the options?
Yeah, I'm thinking as well, it could be likely that it would actually get banned. I think it just depends whether they can actually prove that the safety concerns are, like, whether they're actually as big as they've been made out to be. I think it will kind of come down to that, really. So,
yeah, I think I'm turning around after Lindsay's argument, to be honest. I think I'm going to stand back from my bold stake.
Sorry,
in the ground,
my argument made sense because it didn't make sense to me in my head. That was a ramble and a half.
No, it made a lot of sense. It made a lot of sense, yeah.
I wonder whether the model that they set for TikTok Shop in Indonesia might be an interesting case for precedent, because, you know, they were banned from TikTok Shop after the government said that TikTok was having a bad effect. God, truth words. Detrimental was the word I'm looking for. A detrimental effect on bricks and mortar retail in the country. And TikTok's response to that was to buy a local e-commerce provider and become part of the Indonesian ecosystem. So that was the response. So I wonder what options there will be during this court case when the arguments are coming up as to what else TikTok could do aside from be banned entirely or divest. I wonder whether they've got a play in their pocket.
That's really interesting, like a sort of like bargaining chip to kind of go, well, what if we did this? Would that help you change your mind? But again, like, you know, India banned it and they've survived. So I think, but the TikTok shop thing, that is actually a mouthful. They shouldn't have called it that. Is very, very interesting because in like Southeast Asian countries like Indonesia, like, you know, the bricks and mortar and the kind of physical retail is so important, and it makes up such a massive, massive part of their economy. That it's, again, it's the evolve or die thing. TikTok saying, okay, we'll join you in this and we'll offer you this. it makes so much sense. And I do wonder if anything could change the minds of the government, the US government now. Anything at all. Any nugget? Probably not.
Yeah, it seemed like they were very set on it. I mean, most people voted it through in the government. So it was like an overwhelming majority that were in favour of passing it. So
yeah, well, of course, there's the election coming up as well. Who's going to lobby who the hardest over that as well?
There's that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I've put my bold stake in the ground and then removed it really quickly. So I'm no longer being bold today.
Your left bold stake.
Yes, there is no bold stake now. Whatever will be. I'm no longer making bold sweeping statements.
Okay, I think that's a good place to wrap it up for today then. So yeah, thanks both for joining me for my first regular episode.
Thanks, Amy. You did brilliantly.
You
had a lot to deal with today.
Okay, thanks everyone for listening. That was today's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast.